You know what time it is. It's time for Ask a Spaceman. I'm your host, Paul Sutter. You've got questions and I've got answers. You know how the show works, but there's going to be a quiz at the end, so let's go through it again. So you go online to Twitter or Facebook, use the hashtag AskASpaceman, send some questions, and then sometime in the future, could be a week from now, could be a month from now, could be a year from now, at some point I'll get to your question and I'll answer it on this show. Yeah, you can also email me at askaspaceman@gmail.com. You can also go to askaspaceman.com and there you'll find the show notes. You can put comments. You can ask your questions there. So many ways to ask a question, so little time. We have one simple goal with this show: complete knowledge of time and space. You know, it's a modest goal, to be honest. But, you know, let's do it anyway, because even small goals are worthwhile, right? They give us a feeling of accomplishment. One quick note before I jump into today's episode. This is a on-the-road edition. I am in lovely Trieste, Italy. I'm spending a week here. I spend a lot of time here, actually. But I have to record my episodes here. So I don't have my usual expensive microphone. I didn't really feel comfortable transporting that in my bag and risk losing it and all that stuff. So I've got a cheaper microphone. So the sound quality isn't as good. I apologize for that. Also, it's a little bit loud in my little hotel room. I'm right at the top floor, so right above me is the roof, and like birds and stuff scurry around. I guess birds don't really scurry, like squirrels or whatever. There's something scurrying on the roof here and making some noise. There's scooters outside that drive by. There's trumpets playing sometimes. They're doing some construction in the hotel, so I apologize if there's any background noise. I'll try my best to kind of filter that out later, but you know, I'm not exactly a professional, so yeah, this is what you get. So anyway, today's question on the road to complete knowledge of time and space comes from, usually I have trouble pronouncing people's names. All right, we've been through this before. This is especially difficult because I got a Facebook message and this gentleman's name was in Greek letters. And so I ran it through Google Translate, and I think your name is Rafael Ribeiro. I could be completely wrong, but whatever your name is, you had a great question. You asked, what exploded the Big Bang? Right? The Big Bang, the cosmological model, the expansion of the universe. What banged the Big Bang to make it so big? And I get this kind of question all the time. Like, in general, just what is the Big Bang theory? And where was this explosion? And how did it happen? All right, so first off, I should explain what is, or more importantly, I should say what is not the Big Bang theory. All right? The Big Bang Theory is not a theory of the origins of the universe. It just isn't. It's not. That is not what the Big Bang Theory is about. The Big Bang Theory is a model of the history of the universe. Going back to very early moments, some of the earliest moments of the universe, and describing the evolution in the history of the universe since those earliest moments. But it is not a theory of the quote-unquote beginning of the universe. Because I get that question a lot. The Big Bang, we say, is the beginning of the universe. Well, what happened before the Big Bang? I get that question too, and I'll talk about that a little bit at the end of what we mean, of if there's any concept at all of before the Big Bang. But this is the most important part. Big Bang Theory, not a theory of the origins of the universe. It's a theory of the history of the universe. And the concept of Big Bang encapsulates a lot of physics, of course, because the universe is a kind of complicated place. And I'll get to that. But here's the basic idea of Big Bang Theory. At one time in the past, the universe that we see today with the stars and galaxies and the size, you know, and everything, the entire universe was the size of a peach and had a temperature of over a trillion degrees. Now, you can substitute any handy fruit For a peach, you could pick a grapefruit. You could pick an apple. You know, there's lots of varieties of fruits. Don't pick a banana. That'd be a little messed up. But the basic idea is this whole entire universe that we see with this massive distance. We talked about how big the universe is, that in the past it was smaller. It was so small. And when you take a bunch of stuff and crunch it together, it's going to get more dense and it's going to get hotter. So in that sense, the Big Bang, what banged the Big Bang was the whole universe. The whole universe is banging. Ugh. There's no explosion here. It's not like, hey, over there was a big ball of fire that blew up and that made the Big Bang and created the universe. No. We're not talking about the creation of the universe. We're talking about the history of the universe. And we're saying that in the distant past, the universe was smaller and hotter. The whole universe expanded. It didn't explode. It expanded. And that expansion continues today. The universe is still growing, and just in the past, it was smaller. And that's how we came across the idea of the Big Bang Theory, how we first started thinking about that, because we noticed 100 years ago, Edwin Hubble made some observations, noticed that the universe is expanding, that every galaxy is drifting further away from every other galaxy. And, you know, you just kind of run the clock backwards. You say, if it's expanding now, then that means yesterday the galaxies were close together just a little bit. And the day before they were even closer. And the week before they were closer. And a million years ago they were pretty close. And when the solar system first formed, they were really close. And that's it. That leads you into this Big Bang idea. And it's hard to come, it's hard to express just how revolutionary of an idea this Big Bang evolving universe concept is. Because for the longest time, if you just had to pick like a random model of the universe, if you had to guess what the universe was like, you would probably guess, you know, maybe had a beginning, some creation moment, but that the universe was pretty much the same last week as it is this week. It was pretty much the same a million years ago or a billion years ago as it is today. And it's pretty much going to be the same a billion years from now or 10 billion years from now. That, yeah, like stars explode and people, you know, evolve and launch rockets. Like there's all sorts of little things going on, but the big picture, and we're talking cosmology, this is the big picture. On the big picture, the universe pretty much stays the same day to day. But this observation of the expanding universe threw that whole thing out the window, right? It's the universe is not eternal. The universe does not stay the same all throughout time. It changes and it evolves. The universe was different in the past and it will be different. It'll have a different character. It'll have a different nature in the future. So actually, I think this month I'm going to make it like the cosmology month. This episode, I'm going to talk about the past. And then next episode, I'm going to talk about the future of the universe and show how remarkably different they are. The universe does not stay the same over time. On average, it changes. And why is it expanding? You can immediately ask, oh, we find ourselves in an expanding universe. This is just an observational fact. Why is it expanding? Well, turns out general relativity kind of tells you that the universe doesn't really have a choice. For there to be a static universe where, you know, the galaxies stay the same distance away from every other galaxy is really actually unstable. It's like balancing on your tiptoes on the edge of a cliff or the top of a hill. Yeah, it's possible, but any tiny little nudge will send you rolling down the hill. You're in an unstable state. And the universe, if it's static, it's possible, but it'll be very unstable. Any natural inclination it has, it'll be more likely to start either contracting or expanding. It's just the way the universe has to be. We'll get to that in a little bit. From the window, so it lights me up. and there's like a camera set up and microphone and everything. I had to explain in very bad Italian, but they seemed okay with it. Anyway, so we say, you'll often hear that the universe is like 13.8 billion years old. Like the latest measurements from some satellite or some observations pin down the age of the universe. And immediately two questions come to mind. Like, since when? Like, if the Big Bang Theory is not a theory of the beginning or the origins of the universe, how can we say that the universe is 13.8 billion years old? And this immediately leads to a question. Like, okay, the universe is 13.8 billion years old, but I thought you said the Big Bang Theory wasn't a theory about the origins of the universe. So how can you say that the universe has an age if you can't even talk about the beginning of the universe? So let's go there, all right? I'll take you on a journey from the present day going into the past and see where this notion of the age of the universe actually comes from, and how the Big Bang Theory is a theory of the history of the universe, not necessarily a theory of the origins of the universe. And what I'm about to present to you is based on tons of observations, you know, 50 to 100 years of really hard work by astronomers, by cosmologists, by physicists, by astrophysicists, trying to figure this out, trying to reconstruct the history of the universe. In some cases, we have direct observations. Right? And that's because of the travel time of light. Light only goes so fast. It goes at the speed of light, which is pretty fast, but compared to the size of the universe and the age of the universe, it's pretty slow. For example, it takes light 8 minutes to come here from the sun, which means the light that's shining on my face right now is 8 minute old light. It's the picture of the sun as it was 8 minutes ago. So you look into the past 8 minutes. Light from distant stars that are light years away, that's years of travel time. So you're looking further into the past. Galaxies that are millions of light years away, you're looking millions of years into the past, and on and on and on. The further out you go, the older the light is, the more into the past you're seeing. And so it's just that the light from the universe over there was sent when that patch of the universe was pretty young, and it's just now reaching us today. It took a while to travel here, like a postcard. So in some cases, we don't have direct observations, so we have to use physics, and we have to use mathematics, we have to use our brains, and we can still make predictions, because what happens in the very early universe has an impact on what comes later. So we can say, okay, so if such and such happened in the early universe, it will have some present day effects or have some effects on something that we can observe. And this is how we can test the models. It's like a cosmic crime scene, right? We see certain things in the universe and we're trying to reconstruct the story of what happened to make that crime scene. And in some cases, especially the very early universe, we're just guessing. And I'll tell you the parts where we're just totally guessing about and why we're just guessing about. And the story here, the story of the universe is based on density. The density of the universe over time controls what's happening, controls the physics of what's happening, controls what's important, what's playing a role. And that's because the universe is filled with different kinds of stuff. There's people, there's rocks, there's cheeseburgers, there's light, there are neutrinos, there's dark matter, there's dark energy, there's even more cheeseburgers. There's a variety of stuff. And at different densities, so as the universe is expanding or didn't pass when the universe was smaller, some of these components play a bigger role at those densities than others. And then as the universe expands and cools, maybe some parts drop off, they're not so important anymore, and then other parts take over. So it's really the history of the universe is the story of this changing temperatures and densities, and then what kind of physics play a role at those temperatures and densities. So I'll start today. So today we have a somewhat cool universe. And I don't mean cool as in like a cool person. I mean cold. It's relatively cold. Yeah, there's stars and there's galaxies. In fact, there's lots of galaxies and we have lots of continual star formation going on. We have production of heavy elements inside of supernova, inside of big stars. But overall, on the big scale, things are pretty chill. And we actually find that our universe isn't just expanding, but the expansion itself is accelerating, which means not only is the universe getting bigger and bigger, but the universe is getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster every day. We call this dark energy. We're not exactly sure what dark energy is. I'll talk about more about dark energy and the role it plays, because that's kind of a future thing. I'll talk about that in the next episode. If we go back in time, nothing really changes for a few billion years. There's stars, there's galaxies, there's dinosaurs, there's all sorts of stuff. Around 5 billion years ago is when dark energy really started getting its game on. So dark energy was, whatever's causing it, was always kind of there in the background, but the universe was so dense because you had so much stuff crammed into a smaller volume. Like, the universe was about half its present size of 5 billion years ago. So you have the same amount of stuff crammed in a smaller volume. So the density of stuff was higher, that it kind of ruled the day. Like it was boss, it was in charge. Dark energy was just kind of in the background. And then as the universe expanded, it diluted, it thinned out all the stuff. And then dark energy, which is hanging out, now finds itself on top because there's so few stuff, so little matter spread over so much of volume that dark energy can start doing its thing. So about the same time that the sun and earth formed, about 5 billion years ago, is when dark energy really got going. And it's about when the universe was half its present size, 5 billion years ago. And if we want to go back to the next interesting epoch or transition, that was about 13 billion years ago. This is when the first stars were born, right? You know, it takes time for stars to form. There haven't always been stars in our universe. And the first stars came online relatively young. We call this the cosmic dawn, coincided with another interesting epoch called the epoch of reionization. I talked about the formation of the first stars in an earlier episode. And we call this the cosmic dawn because before this, we call it the dark ages. How cool is that? They're atoms, they're stuff in the universe, but there really isn't a lot of light. I mean, there's photons floating around, but there's no starlight, there's no galaxies. It looks a lot different than the universe does today. Once the first stars switch on, once the first galaxies form, the universe looks a lot like it does today. But before this, in the first few hundred million years, the universe really was a different place. It was a dark place. And at this time, 13 billion years ago, the universe was about 1/10 of its present size. So you can imagine it's hotter, it's denser, because you've got all this stuff crammed into a volume 1/10 its current size. The next major epoch, change happens around 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And notice how I've kind of changed my notation, my wording. Instead of counting backwards from now, it's easier to start marking time from the quote-unquote beginning. So I'm going to say things like 300,000 years after the Big Bang or a second after the Big Bang. And at the end, I'll tell you what I actually mean when I'm marking time that way. Because I just went on a whole big rant about the Big Bang is really just the whole expansion of the universe. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense to say 300,000 years after the Big Bang if the Big Bang is still kind of happening today. All right. But anyway, 300,000 years into the history of the universe, into the evolution of the universe, if you cram stuff down so small, at this time the universe is around 1/1000th of its present size. The universe is just way too hot. It's too hot for atoms. You can't have nuclei surrounded by electrons. It's too hot for that. They keep slamming into each other and crashing and mosh pitting, and it's horrible and sweaty. It's a plasma. right? Anytime an atom forms, a high energy photon just knocks it off. It's just, you can't have atoms. It's a plasma. Just like the surface of the sun, just like a lightning bolt, it's a plasma, but the whole universe is a plasma, which is pretty awesome. And so this transition happened around 300,000 years into the history of the universe, where it became cool enough to form atoms, and this triggered what we call the cosmic microwave background. It's like the leftover light from this epoch that was finally freed. And before this, the universe was just too soupy to see. So really, this cosmic microwave background is like the earliest light that we can see. It's pretty early. It's like almost 13.8 billion years old, almost as old as the universe itself. It's like a baby picture of the universe, not a picture of the birth, but it's like an infant universe. And that light that was released in this transitional epoch persists today. And a long time ago, it was really hot because the universe was hot. But over time, the light got stretched off, it cooled off, and now it's in the microwave. And it actually dominates the sky. So you can put on goggles, if you could put on goggles that let you see microwave light, it would completely fill up the sky. It's brighter than the sun, brighter than any stars. It completely dominates any source of light in the universe. It's there. It's the leftover afterglow of the Big Bang. So that topic, the cosmic microwave background, deserves its whole other show, because we learned so much about the universe from studying this light. There's tiny bumps and wiggles that lead to the seeds of galaxies and superclusters. It allows us to peer back even further. Stuff that happens early in the universe leaves an imprint on this cosmic microwave background. So please, someone ask just what is the cosmic microwave background so I can do an episode about it. It's so cool. And so, like I said, we can't directly observe the universe before the creation of this cosmic microwave background. Because it's too soupy, it's too hot. Light can't penetrate it. But what happens in that early universe leaves an imprint on the CMB that we can observe. So we can go back in time. We can use our knowledge of physics. The universe is getting hotter. The universe is getting denser in these early moments. But it's still physics that we understand. It's physics that we can like replicate in nuclear reactors or particle accelerators. So we can still have some understanding of what's going on. And if we go back to 10 seconds into the history of the universe. So the universe is only 10 seconds old. The universe is 1/1,000,000th of its present size. And it's this stage that it's too hot for nuclei. Like after this epoch, you have things like helium, you have deuterium, you have lithium, you have some elements other than just, you know, protons and neutrons floating around. But prior to this, the universe is too hot and too dense for those to survive. So you have a plasma, again, but a plasma made of protons and stuff. And it's at this epoch, around 10 seconds in, that there's an event called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So basically what's happening here is that the temperatures are high enough that fusion can occur. So it's just like the inside of the sun, right? You can bang atoms together and make new ones. You can make new elements. And this is where the first elements come from. The helium, deuterium, the lithium. These are the seeds of the stuff in our universe. Later on, they'll get processed inside of stars to give us all the carbon and the oxygen. And in supernova, we'll get some more elements to fill out the whole periodic table. But at this early stage in the universe, you just have those few primordial elements. And it happened here. Let's go back even further to just 1 microsecond into the age of the universe. 1 microsecond. So we've jumped before. We were talking about 10 seconds in. Now we're at 1 microsecond. The universe is, let's just go with tiny. Let's just go with small. Like, it's just a small number. I mean, who cares? I mean, lots of people care. It's a tiny number. The universe is small. And now it's even hotter and denser because you've crammed all this stuff into a tiny little volume. and it's too hot here even for protons and neutrons. Right? You can think of all these stages as the universe cools off, things can coalesce. So before this epoch, before microsecond, it's even too hot for protons and neutrons. You try to have a proton, and a proton is made of quarks, and so are neutrons. So protons and neutrons themselves are made of smaller particles, but they're crashing into each other too much to be stable. After this period, after a microsecond, it cools off enough that they can glop together, these quarks can glop together into protons and neutrons. Later on, 10 seconds in, it cools off where the protons and neutrons can glop together to form atoms and elements. Later on, 300,000 years in, those elements can start getting electrons to orbit them and to stay in shells, and you can create the first atoms and molecules. And this is just the process in reverse. You go to hotter and hotter and more intense. You're basically just smashing stuff together at even higher energies. And this is what you get. You get plasmas that are weirder and weirder, made of more fundamental stuff. So prior to a microsecond into the history of the universe is what we call a quark gluon plasma. So it's an analogy to the atoms. You rip apart the electrons off of an atom and you have a hot plasma. Now you rip apart protons and neutrons and you're left with the stuff that protons and neutrons are made of, which are quarks and gluons, which are the glue that hold them together. So it's the stuff that makes the very primordial stuff, protons and neutrons, that's all smashed together in a big messy ball up until the universe is a microsecond old. And it's at this point that we start to transition from physics that we know pretty well, actually. It sounds really crazy, but we've actually got a good handle on the physics of this, of these epochs of the universe. But prior to a microsecond into the history of the universe, it starts to get a little bit difficult. Like, the physics starts to get a little bit sketchier. Our understanding starts to break down, and that's because the densities, the temperatures, the energies are so high that we just don't have a good grip on them experimentally. We can't replicate it in experiments or particle colliders. And the physics starts to get a little bit more difficult. The math gets more difficult. That said, we still have some intuition of what's going on. So let's go all the way to a picosecond. Now we're at the stage, the universe is only a picosecond old. A picosecond is 10 to the minus 12 seconds for those keeping track. And at this stage, all of the stuff in the universe is crammed into such a tiny volume that is too hot, too dense, too energetic for there to be separate forces. All right. We've gone past breaking down atoms. We've gone past breaking down nuclei. We've gone past breaking down protons and neutrons. Now we're breaking down the fundamental forces of nature. That's what we're talking about here. You've got four forces of nature: gravity, electromagnetism, strong nuclear, and weak nuclear. The way we understand physics, and this has to be another show where I get into the details here because it's such a fascinating concept. What we think of as the four separate forces of nature are actually manifestations of a single force, but this single force only appears at a single force at incredibly high temperatures and densities and energies. And as it cools off, as you go to lower energies, like the low energy universe that we live in today, these forces kind of break apart, like splinter off as the universe cools down. And we actually understand this. So the first two forces that can merge together, as you go up to higher and higher energy levels, and higher temperatures and higher densities, electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force actually merge together into a single force. We call it the electroweak force. And this is one of the triumphs of particle theory in the past 50 years, is recognizing how these forces are actually related and how the four forces of nature are actually different facets of the same thing that in our low energy universe look totally, totally different, but at high energies are really, really the same thing. I know I'm doing a very high level description. If you want me to get into the guts of that and what that means, that's a whole other half hour show. Trust me. And it's weird, but it's something we can actually study and probe on Earth. Our particle colliders are designed to kind of explore this regime where the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force are combined into the electroweak force. And so, 1 picosecond after the Big Bang, any earlier than this, the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force glue together. They're a single force. So prior to this, when the universe is less than a picosecond old, there are only three forces. There's gravity, there's strong nuclear, and there's the electroweak force. There's no four forces in nature, there's only three. Now, you go back even further. You go to when the universe is only 10 to the minus 36 seconds old. So we're really pushing the clock back here. And now you can probably guess what's going to happen. The universe is even hotter, even denser, more energetic. Another force glues onto it. Now it's the strong nuclear force's turn to glue on. Now you have two forces of nature. When the universe is 10 to the minus 36 seconds old, there are only two forces of nature. There's gravity and there's something else. We kind of call it GUT, the grand unified theory. There's a few candidates. Here's a situation where we're not exactly sure what's going on. The grand unified theory is a theory that combines electromagnetism, weak nuclear, and strong nuclear under a single force at incredibly high temperatures and densities. Again, a little bit speculative here. We have some guidance. There are some pretty solid ideas that make some experimental predictions, and we're starting to understand this GUT theory, but it's still difficult to understand. So at this time in the universe, in the age of the universe, there's two forces, gravity and GUT. That's what you got. Now, something interesting happens when the strong nuclear force separates off. When the universe cools off just enough for that strong nuclear force to peel off away from the GUT force, it triggers something. It triggers a super rapid expansion of the universe. We call this event inflation because the universe inflated really, really quick. So in a tiny fraction of a second, like literally like some incredibly tiny fraction of a second, the universe went from going about the size of an atomic nucleus. Remember, the whole entire universe, that's what we're talking about here. The whole, everything you can see, every galaxy, every star, everything the universe is made of is crammed into the volume of an atomic nucleus. This super rapid expansion that's triggered when the strong force splits off. It's like, poosh, the universe blows up. And if you could say anything's banging the Big Bang, this would be a good candidate. I wouldn't fault you for saying this. Universe goes from being the size of an atomic nucleus to being the size of a peach or a grapefruit or a small coconut or a large apple. Not a pear, not a banana. Pineapple is a little sketchy. Okay, but you get the idea. That doesn't seem like a lot, but really the universe grew to be 10 to the 28 times bigger. And these are just ridiculous numbers. I mean, just think this event that we call inflation, the universe got really, really big, really, really fast, less than a second. And then after that continued its normal expansion. So this idea of inflation was first used to explain certain other features of the universe, like how uniform it all is, other things. It was at the start in the 70s when this idea was first developed. It was just kind of like a guess. But over time, it seems to be on the right track. And whatever happens during inflation, we don't fully understand inflation, what actually drove this rapid expansion. We know it was triggered by the strong nuclear force branching off, but we don't really fully understand what actually drove that rapid expansion. But we're starting to, because whatever caused it left an imprint on the cosmic microwave background. 300,000 years later, there's a little like signature of it. And this is how what we're using to try to study inflation. So different things, different ideas that might have caused inflation, triggered that rapid expansion, will leave a very subtle signature on that cosmic microwave background, and we're really good at observing the cosmic microwave background, so we can pin down. So we've pinned down pretty much that something like inflation did happen. That's pretty, you can't get around that with our detailed observations of the cosmic microwave background. You can't really get around the fact that something happened, but we're just now like kind of teasing out, trying to figure out exactly what did happen. So we're pretty sure that something like inflation did occur, but we're not exactly sure what. And whatever drove inflation, whatever caused this rapid expansion, eventually kind of fizzled out like a firecracker or something, like, and in that little fizzles, it created all these fundamental particles that would end up being glued together to form protons and neutrons and nucleotides and elements and atoms and everything. That was kind of seeded in this moment of inflation. So before this epoch of inflation, before this incredibly rapid expansion of the universe, and by rapid here I mean less than a second, and expansion it ends up being the size of a peach, which seems small to us, but back then it was huge. It's so hot and dense that three out of the four known forces of nature were united. We're at what's called the gut scale. And I'm not talking about your stomach. I'm talking about the grand unified theory scale, the scale where strong nuclear, weak nuclear, electromagnetic are all bound together as a single force. That seems weird to think about, but that's how our picture of the universe is. That there's, at this scales, at this time, there's only two forces of nature. There's gravity and there's the gut force. And here at this epoch, at these early times in the universe, it's very sketchy, but at least we have some theoretical insights. There are some mathematics and some physics that allow us to kind of peek inside what the universe was like at these early times. There's at least some perspective. We have some gut models. We have some ways of arranging the forces of nature that we can understand them at these scales. Earlier than that, it's tough because at even smaller scales, before this inflationary epoch happens, you're dealing with extremely strong gravity at extremely small scales. And we simply don't understand strong gravity at small scales. We understand strong gravity at big scales, that's general relativity. And we understand weak gravity at all scales, that's Newtonian physics. But we don't understand strong gravity at small scales. We don't understand the scale where gravity merges together with the other forces of nature. We don't even know if gravity does merge together. We have some intuition that it does because we've had so much success merging the other forces together at very high energies. It could be that at such tiny scales that we're past a gut theory and we're at a toe theory, T-O-E, a theory of everything, where all the forces of nature that appear so different to us today are actually the same force, just one force at very high energies and at the very earliest moments of the universe that's strong enough, or it's hot enough, it's dense enough, it's energetic enough, that these four forces aren't expressed differently like they are today. They're all expressed the same way. There's only one force that's kind of operating. But here at these scales, not only have you passed the point of observations, but you've passed the point of theory. Like, we don't even have reliable theories of everything. There are some highly speculative ideas. But we just don't understand. We just don't have a good picture of what the universe is doing in these earliest moments. And if you push back even further, let's say you want to go totally nuts and keep pushing back past the scale where all the forces are combined, eventually you arrive at what's called the singularity, where the universe keeps getting hotter and hotter and denser and smaller, where it's infinitely hot and infinitely dense and infinitely small. And we know that that doesn't really make sense at all, but we can't tackle it yet until we've come up with a theory that can explain, until we can come up with a mathematical tool set that explains how the universe behaves at the earliest moments, until we can develop a language to talk about it. It's like our current language of describing the universe and the evolution of the universe in its very earliest moments simply doesn't have the word to describe what's going on, or the proper words to describe what's going on. So we just call it singularity. When we know that something's breaking down, it's a singularity in our models. In our language is incapable of describing what's going on. And we're trying to put together the language that we can use to explain what's going on. So we believe the Big Bang picture is generally correct because of the overwhelming evidence. Like we have evidence of the expansion of the universe. We have baby pictures of the universe. We have pictures of the universe when it's only 300,000 years old, like the cosmic microwave background. Just, you can Google search it. Cosmic microwave background. There you go. There's a baby picture of the universe. So we don't just believe in the Big Bang Theory for kicks and giggles because it amuses us. We believe it because of the overwhelming evidence in its favor. That, and like I said, the Big Bang Theory is a model of the history of the universe. At some point, the model breaks down. It breaks down where all the forces are combined. When you're near what we call the singularity, everything after that we have a pretty good picture of. But we don't know what happens earlier than that. And we don't know what happens before that. And we don't even know, get this, if that question even makes sense. Because at the very smallest scales, when you're crunching the universe down to such tiny scales, even notions like time and space, like we're used to, kind of break down. Where duration or length, those concepts which make total sense in our universe today, don't make sense at those small scales. That's how weird the universe is getting in the very earliest moments. So it may not even make sense to talk about a before, because there may not be any such concept. Like, the physics, the language that we developed to explain the very early universe may not even permit the concept of a before, for there to be a before the Big Bang. I know that hurts. I know that might give you a nosebleed. It hurts my brain too, but this is the method we're using to explain the very early universe. It's a tiny little question mark at the very earliest moments, like 10 to the minus 30 or 40 seconds into the age of the universe, we don't understand what's going on. Everything after that, we get progressively better and better at explaining, either with theory or with direct observations. And that's what we call the Big Bang picture, the model of the universe, the history of the universe. And we don't even know if, like, origin of the universe even makes sense in this context. There are some speculative ideas, and I highlight the word speculative, bold, uppercase, everything. Speculative ideas out there, like colliding brains. And I don't mean brain as in your head. I mean like a multi-dimensional sheet in a higher dimensional space, and they like bounce off each other and then they come back. Okay, like there's a bunch of ideas out there like that. If any of these speculative ideas can produce unambiguous observational hooks, like, oh yes, 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 look for this signature in the cosmic microwave background, then yay. Then that's great. Develop those ideas, flesh them out, let's test them. if they can't find a way to distinguish it from any other model, then I'm not interested in hearing it. All right, it may make for a great story, but it's not something I'm interested in as a scientist. I'm interested in things that I can test. I'm interested in models that I can use observations to judge against. And if you can't give me a way to judge it, then I don't even want to hear your story. It's fun, but it might as well be fiction. Mathematical-based fiction, plausible fiction, but fiction nonetheless. If you can produce observational clues that we can look for, then you've gone from fiction to science. And we can start figuring out what's going on. Maybe we can peek into the quote-unquote origins of the universe through some observational signatures in the universe we have today. Maybe the concept of origin doesn't make sense. Maybe the scales are so small and so tiny and so hot that we'll never understand it. We'll never put together a theory of everything. Maybe that question mark will get smaller and smaller and smaller, pushed back further and further, but maybe it won't ever quite go away. That's life. I mean, scientists were concerned with questions that we can answer. And if there are questions we can't answer, then we drop and we move on to something else. That's just the way it goes. And I'm totally happy with that. So the answer to the question is like, what banged the Big Bang? Well, everything banged the Big Bang. We're still living in the Big Bang today. The whole entire universe is expanding. What came before it or what generated it, we don't know. We don't even know if that's a knowable question. And we don't even know if that question makes sense. Our model, our picture of the universe carries us back so far, only so far. Earlier than that, we don't know what's going on. We just don't know. Maybe someday we will. So thanks so much for listening. I'd especially like to thank the folks who contributed to my Fiat Physica campaign, Teodori Varno and Mr. or Mrs. Anonymous. Thank you so much. If you haven't checked out my other shows, realspacepodcast.com and Space in Your Face on YouTube, you absolutely should, because they're lots of fun to do. Thanks again, Rafael Ribeiro, if that is your name, for today's questions. Go ahead and go to askaspaceman.com to check out show notes, comment on the episodes, give me some feedback, give me some more questions. You can also send questions to askaspaceman@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Paul Matt Sutter. PaulMattSutter. Lots of T's, but you can handle it. And you can also keep asking questions for #AskASpaceman. And keep them coming. You know what? Let's answer all the questions. That's what we want to do. See you next time with more complete knowledge of time and space.